welcome to this Wednesday, September 25th, 2013 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, and also available via podcast. I'm your guest host, Nicole Nelson, and as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week, Barbara DeMarco Barrett is here with authors, poets, literary agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. It's our pleasure to be joined today by two authors. During the second half hour, I will be talking to poet Gary Soto, and I will begin by speaking with Dara Horn. Dara has a PhD in comparative literature from Harvard University, studying Hebrew and Yiddish. In 2007, she was chosen by Grant's Magazine as one of America's best young American novelists. Her first novel, In the Image, received several awards, as did her second, The World to Come. All Other Nights, her third, was one of Booklist's 25 best books of the decade. In 2012, her nonfiction ebook, The Rescuer, was published by Tablet Magazine and became a Kindle bestseller. Her newest novel, A Guide for the Perplexed, was published by Norton this month. This is her first time on Writers on Writing, and it is my pleasure to welcome her to the show. Dara, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start by having you introduce your book. Could you tell us about it?
Sure. My newest novel is called A Guide for the Perplexed, and it's the story of a software developer named Josie Ashkenazi, who creates a software program that records everything its users do. She then receives an invitation from an Egyptian library to come to Egypt to help digitize their archives. She doesn't really want to go, but she has a sister who's very jealous of her, who insists that she go. And while she's there, this coincides with the Egyptian Revolution, and she ends up being kidnapped, which allows her sister to then take over her life. There's also a historical component to the book about the discovery of a medieval archive of manuscripts in a 900-year-old Cairo synagogue. So the book really explores a lot of the questions of what we save, why we save it, data storage then and now, and how technology changes memory and how memory shapes the soul. So that's what the book is about, A Guide for the Perplexed.
Yeah, there are a lot of big questions that you address. I was curious with archiving. What's your relationship with personal archiving? Are you an archiver yourself?
Well, I think all of us, in effect, have become archives, right? I mean, since I was a child, I've had a kind of a fantasy of turning life into an archive, of recording everything so that nothing could be lost. And I think a lot of writers have this impulse of keeping journals and this kind of thing. Now, of course, social media has made my dream come true, and has turned it into a nightmare where every idiotic thing you ever do is recorded forever. And I think we're even now even more aware of how much of data is stored about us and by us. What I was interested in exploring in this book was how that changes how we see who we are. Because I know that I'm 36 years old, and when I was a child, my parents took pictures of our family when I was growing up, and they have a whole shelf, floor-to-ceiling shelf in their house with all the records of pictures of us growing up. I have four children of my own now, and if I were to print every picture that I've taken of my children or that my husband has taken of our children, it would fill a room. And my oldest child is only eight. So what that's really made me question is how we, in some way, are losing the art of forgetting. Because in a sense, it's not saving everything that allows you to bring meaning to your past, but it's rather selecting from that past what's worth saving that turns your past into a story that's meaningful.
Yeah, and in the book, you interweave this modern, very visionary storyline with these two historical storylines that are based on real figures. Did you do... there must have been a lot of research involved for those two storylines.
Well, yes. I mean, as you mentioned, I have a doctorate. I'm kind of a professional nerd, so it was important to me to get the details right. Yes, as you mentioned, the book has sort of three historical threads. There's the main one, which is this contemporary story about this software developer who's kidnapped in contemporary Egypt. The second one is about a Cambridge professor named Solomon Schechter, who went to Egypt to discover, he had sort of heard about this this medieval archive that was kept in this Cairo synagogue. There's a religious law in Judaism that you're not allowed to throw any piece of paper away that has God's name on it. And so many Jewish communities, even to this day, have a storage room or a storage space that's called a geniza. The word means a hiding place, where they keep these damaged books that can no longer be used, but that can't be thrown away. And traditionally, these books are then later buried. This synagogue in Cairo, which was built in the 900s, had a room like this, but they had the custom of not just saving sacred documents, but saving any documents that were written in Hebrew letters. And they hadn't emptied this room in over 900 years. So when Schechter came from England and discovered this room, what he found was 150,000 pieces of paper going back 1,000 years. And some of these were important literary documents, but a lot of them were really junk. I mean, they were things like sales receipts, love letters, children's schoolwork. It wasn't really an archive. What it really was a medieval Facebook, right? It was a repository of everyone's daily lives in a community. And so that's something that I looked into a lot. And then what the story then goes back into the life of Moses Maimonides, who was a 12th century Jewish philosopher, but also he was a scientist. He was a doctor for the Egyptian Sultan. And his most famous work is a book called A Guide for the Perplexed, which sort of tries to reconcile science and religion and asks that question that we're still asking now, which is, how much of our lives do we really control? How much of our lives is free will, and how much of our lives is predetermined by forces beyond our control, whether those are supernatural force, as he may have believed, or natural forces, natural laws. And those questions really still haunt us now. So while, yes, I did a lot of research for them, a lot of the themes, I think, are the themes that follow the book through. Each of these stories are very universal.
Right. And so would you read to us from your book?
Sure. I'm going to read just right from the beginning of the book, so I don't need to explain anything, but what this passage introduces is my main character, Josie Ashkenazi, and her invention, which is a software program called Geniza that saves everything its users do and how that impacts her life. What happens to days that disappear? The light fades, the gates begin to close, and all that a day once held, a glance, a fight, a taste of bread, thousands of worries and triumphs and regrets. All of it slips between those closing gates, vanishing into a dark and silent room. When Josephine Ashkenazi first invented Geniza, all she wanted to do was open those gates. At least that was how it started. In its earliest versions, the program Josie invented was little more than a variant on dozens of others. But then the software grew. By the time she was 24 years old, Geniza was a vast platform that saved not only material its users deliberately created, but essentially everything they did, cataloging worlds of data according to the user's instincts. By the time she was 26, Geniza didn't merely store data, but tracked it. By the time she was 27, she had married the company's chief engineer, had been the subject of a documentary, and had a baby. By the time she was 33, her six-year-old daughter Tali's every moment was recorded forever. But Tali knew nothing about it until one morning when, almost by accident, Josie showed her the archive of her life. "I can't find my shoes, Mommy," Tali had announced at breakfast. "I looked and looked, but they're nowhere." "That's impossible," Josie told her. Where did you take them off yesterday?" "I don't remember," Tali said. "And now I can't go to school." Josie sucked in her breath. She stepped to the kitchen counter and grabbed her tablet, entering passwords with a few quick taps. Under local panoramic search, she typed in Tali and then shoes. In an instant, an image appeared of Tali's new sneakers, mid-drop, as they descended from Tali's feet to the floor of Josie's car. "There they are," Josie said, and tipped the screen toward Tali. "You must have taken them off on the way home." Tali gaped and then ran to the garage. Josie followed Tali and watched as her daughter's eyes bulged at the sight of the shoes on the car's floor. Tali shoved her sneakers on and then climbed into the seat, still gaping. "How did you do that?" Tali asked. Josie took the tablet out of her bag and turned it toward her daughter. "I have everything from your life in here," she said. "That picture was pulled off the camera on my phone from when the phone was in that holder between the seats facing you." Tali was baffled. "How did the camera know to take a picture?" "It happens automatically," Josie said. "The camera's running all the time. Then the picture gets saved in a program that I made that collects everything and sorts it. Anything you ever want to remember, it's here. Tali stared at the screen, stunned. Really? Like what? Like everything, Josie said. Here's what happens when I search for your shoes, for instance. She tapped in keywords on the screen. See, these are the first shoes that you ever wore when you were about a year old. And here's where we bought those shoes for you last week, she said. When you got mad at me, Tali muttered. Josie frowned. She hadn't remembered that, though now it occurred to her that the shopping trip had been unpleasant, that she had been distracted by a message from her office, and Tali, in a bid for her attention, had knocked over a large cardboard display case, sending sneakers flying across the store. Josie slid into the driver's seat, unsettled. Is everything from when you were little in there, too? Tali asked. No, actually, Josie admitted. I hadn't invented it yet then. Lucky you, Tali said. Josie paused. Lucky? Why? Because you get to remember everything the way you want, instead of how it really happened.
Thank you. We're speaking with author Dara Horn. And so, Dara, it struck me at some point when I was reading that I was glad the protagonist was a woman. Her achievements and her power are things, you know, that we're used to seeing attributed to male characters. Did you always know that she would be a woman, your protagonist?
Well, I can tell you this, that this is my fourth book, and I after my last book was published, my last book was about Civil War spies. And although there are women characters in that book, the main character is a man. And a couple of different readers had approached me and said, you know, you're a terrific writer, and I was just wondering, why don't you ever write women characters? And I honestly had never thought about it before. But I love a challenge, and so when I started writing this novel, I decided I wanted to focus on women characters. And by making the main character a woman who's a software developer, I was sort of making a point of saying something about the way that gender may not even be relevant to her career. And of course, today, you know, there's something about this book. This book is, of course, set like in the very near future, because the software, of course, doesn't exist, although it almost does. So I wanted to create a female character where her success as a software developer wasn't contingent on her gender, and the subject of the book wasn't her gender, but that just was the way it was, as though that was a normal thing, which I hopefully in the future it will be. Although of course I understand that, you know, there aren't too many female software developers who reach this kind of level that she does in this book.
Right, and I hesitated when I was reading to turn to the back cover and see what category your book was put under, because I assumed it wasn't women's fiction because you have this beautiful cover that doesn't have, you know, a black flat on it or something, or a shoe. But I didn't know if it was more genre like Judaica or thriller. I was curious what, you know, the publishers did for this, but it is general fiction, and so that's
yeah. I mean, it's literary fiction. I think that, but I think that it's a book that would appeal to a lot of different types of readers, because it is about, you know, the central story is about this software developer who's kidnapped in post-revolutionary Egypt, and she ultimately ends up. I mean, I could give away a little bit of the plot and say that you know, she's kidnapped for money, but the people who kidnap her not realizing that software startups don't actually have cash. And they're going to kill her, but then what they discover is that the Egyptian police are using her software for surveillance, and so they keep her alive to create a virus to destroy the Egyptian police records, and of course things unfold from there. So it does have this element of a thriller. It does have this thriller plot, but at the same time, it's also a very intimate story about two sisters and this sort of very acrimonious relationship between them, and how that acrimony between these two women leads to a whole cascade of events beyond either of their control. And it also has this this sort of historical component and a sense of philosophical component, as the book is exploring these questions of memory and how memory shapes who we are and who we become. So I think that, I mean, you know, they just put it under literature, and, you know, to me, a lot of these distinctions can be kind of artificial, actually.
Sure, and that's why I was glad it wasn't forced into, you know, one or the other. But you mentioned the plotting and the intricacy of it. Are you an outliner?
Oh, I wish I were. No, I don't. I don't plan my books at all. In fact, I'm I usually write them sort of the way that you would read them. I'm writing it to see what happens next, because I don't know as I'm going what's going to happen next. That said, I will say that the novel's plot, the main plot of the story of these sisters, it's actually very much drawn from the biblical story of Joseph and his brothers. The story in the Bible about Joseph, who has this ability to interpret dreams. He has kind of this almost supernatural talent, and his brothers are intensely jealous of him. They sell him into slavery in Egypt, and it's later when he's in Egypt that he's, through a complicated series of events, he comes into a position of power where he's in the position to be able to save them. That story is sort of the bare outline of what I took into the contemporary plot, and I made it a contemporary story, and it's about women instead of men. But it still is that story of sibling rivalry and how that tension between siblings can shape their lives in ways that they didn't expect. And it also is that question of the person in the biblical story who's an interpreter of dreams. And I was thinking about what could be the modern equivalent of being an interpreter of dreams. And I really saw a software developer and someone who's really creating this new technology that shapes so much of our lives as being sort of the modern equivalent of an interpreter of dreams.
Okay, in that short section that you read at the outset, it struck me, revisiting that, how you the irony of, yes, you know, the Skeniza program catalogs everything, but yet she forgot that she had been mad when she bought the shoes, and Tali remembers this, and I think that's funny how you make that commentary in the context of the story.
Well, because we think that we can control our lives, right? We think that we control, and that we think that we control our memory in a sense by recording everything. And while this software is fictitious, you know, there's so many ways on social media and with technology that we do record so much of our lives. But yet, it's very rare that we record how we actually feel. Mm-hmm. There's sort of an emotional archive that in some way always has to be lost.
Mm-hmm. How active are you in Facebook for your writing life?
Oh gosh, I mean, I wish I were more. It's not my personality to be sharing and interacting with strangers in that kind of way. It doesn't come naturally to me. My publisher sort of insisted that I have to, be using Facebook and Twitter, and so I do. And it's actually been nice. I mean, I've met a lot of readers that way, and actually just yesterday I was speaking in San Francisco, and I spent the afternoon with a reader who I had never met before, but who I had connected with on Facebook. So I'm certainly not against those kinds of things, but it's definitely something that, it's not a native language to me the way it would be. I'm 36 years old, and maybe if I were 26, it would feel, it would feel more native to me. For me, it almost feels like it's a second language.
Yeah. In your bio, I was intrigued to learn that you have a PhD, in comparative literature. That's a unusual path to becoming a novelist. And I understand you were a novelist before you even earned the degree. So
yes.
How intentional was that path, and how did you make those decisions in terms of your education?
Sure. Well, some of it was the novel part was more luck than, I wanted to be a writer, but, I wasn't counting on it working out. I started the doctoral program. I started applying to doctoral programs at around the same time when I was writing the novel, but yes, and then when I published the novel, it was a little before, I guess, right at the beginning of when I started the doctorate, so it kind of happened at around the same time. But the doctorate was something that my academic field is in Hebrew and Yiddish literature, and, in the humanities, people often feel that, there's often this feeling the world doesn't care about what I do, and it doesn't, does the world really need another dissertation about Shakespeare? That was not my experience, because I'm working in Hebrew and Yiddish, which are languages which very few people use in this country. I mean, obviously in Israel there's a whole country full of people who are speaking Hebrew, but Yiddish in particular is a language that very few people use or speak now. There's this massive 1,000-year-old literature in this language, which in a lot of ways is in danger of being lost or forgotten because there are very few people who have access to it. And so when I embarked on this on this path of study, it was really, in a sense, you know, we talked before about archives and lost things. It was, in a sense, to retrieve things in this archive for which I felt I was one of the few people who had a key to it because I had learned these languages. And so for me, it felt, while it certainly informs my fiction, in a sense, it was a separate obligation that I felt to bring this, the literatures and those languages to a readership that wouldn't otherwise be able to access them.
I see. And when you were earning the PhD and writing research papers, did you have any trouble dividing those two tones in from your novel and from your research?
Well, not really, because I should say that, I mean, they are close. It's not like I have a PhD in neuroscience and then I'm writing novels on the side. I mean, it is like they are very intimately intertwined, because my novels are very much informed by material from Hebrew and Yiddish literature and from Jewish history. But what I will say about it is that in terms of just the technical aspect of doing a PhD and doing a novel at the same time, it actually worked really well, because the nice thing about a PhD is that no one ever expects you to finish it. And so what I would do is I would work on the doctorate until I would get to a point where I was getting stuck and not getting anywhere, and then I would say, oh, well, I'm going to procrastinate on that by working on the novel, and then I'd work on the novel, and then I'd get to a point where I was stuck with that, and I'd say, well, I'll procrastinate on that by working on the doctorate, and so as a result, I managed to finish both of them without ever feeling like I was really working, because I always felt like I was avoiding what I should have been doing instead.
Wow, yeah, I've heard of authors who do that in a different way with, you know, a short story here and a novel there.
Yeah.
That's quite a span you drew. Have you written any short stories, or are you more a novelist?
You know, I've never was a person who, like, had a short stories in my drawer. I never took a writing class. I mean, I know it was, you know, and I think a lot of people write short stories. That's sort of something that's encouraged by writing classes because, you know, they're easy to workshop in a way that a novel sort of isn't. So I didn't come from that kind of background, so I wasn't really writing short stories. That said, I think one time recently I was asked to write a short story for an anthology or something like that, I did. But it was a bit of a joke. I mean, I wrote a story called Shtetl World, which was about, shtetls being these sort of Jewish towns in Eastern Europe, which of course don't exist anymore. And what I did was I imagined that there was something called Shtetl World, which was like Disney World. It was like a theme park that was a recreation of one of these shtetls, like where there are rides and, you know, it's all costumed interpreters who are dressed up and these outfits, and every day at 2 o'clock there's a wedding, every day at 4:30 there's a pogrom. I mean, you know, so it was a joke. I mean, I couldn't have sustained something like that for a whole book, but then it was really, you know, sort of asking readers to question the way that the past is used in the present, and sort of the strangeness of a nostalgia for a past that one has never experienced. But yeah, other than that, I like writing novels. I mean, I'm sort of, the thing about writing a novel is that you're really living in this world of the book for years. I mean, and these people who are your characters are you're living with these people for a long time. You get to know them very well.
Yeah. What is your revision process like? So do you go, you don't outline, but so you make your way through a draft and then you revise, or?
I write like about a chapter at a time. My husband reads them. My husband's not a writer, so I appreciate having him read it because he's not a writer. And, you know, he'll read it and he might offer some suggestions or some thoughts. But then I usually don't even think about it and I just keep going. I don't usually go back to, I write my way through the book. And once I've reached, and because I haven't planned, it's usually only when I reach the end that I realize, I'm like, oh, now I know what this book is about. And now that I've realized what the book is about, I can go back into the beginning of the book and sort of, you know, and shift things and reemphasize some things and you know, de-emphasize others to pull those themes back through the book. So this book actually didn't, the revisions were not too overwhelming. I've had books where I've thrown out hundreds and hundreds of pages, and I've actually twice I did this where I wrote a novel in first person and then I went back and I had to write it in third, you know, I decided it had to be in third person. I had to go and change every single sentence to make the book in first person. But this book, I didn't have anything overly dramatic like that. But I did rethink how I the ways I included the historical sections and how I integrated them into the contemporary story. And also just, you know, it is like a line by line revision. I mean, you do end up, somehow you end up rewriting a lot of the book. I mean, I sort of don't even want to think about how much of the book I ended up rewriting.
Well, you're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're speaking with author Dara Horn. And Dara, we're drawing down on our time, but before we let you go, do you have any writing advice that you'd like to share with our listeners?
It really depends on what you want to do as a writer and what your goals are as a writer. But, the usual advice of never give up and this kind of thing and write every day, I mean, I would endorse all of those things. But another thing I would say is, don't listen to people who say no, because I remember one time, I said I never took a writing class, but it's not true. I did take one writing class in college, a nonfiction writing class, and I did very poorly in it. And at the end of the semester, I went to the professor and I said, I'm doing better in economics than I'm doing in your class, but I always wanted to be a writer since I was a child, and I'm wondering if you have advice for me. And she said to me, I advise you to become an economist. And so I would say I'm very, very glad that I didn't take her advice. And so one thing I would say is that, writing is not a career. It's a disease. It's something that you're going to be doing whether you're lucky enough to be paid for it or not. So if you have that disease, and if you do, if you have that disease, you don't have to listen to people who tell you no.
Wonderful. Well, Dara, thank you again for being on with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dara Horn, author of A Guide for the Perplexed, out by Norton. I'm now joined by Gary Soto. His new and selected poems was a finalist for both the Los Angeles Times Book Prize and the National Book Award in 1995. Gary's first poetry collection, The Elements of San Joaquin, was published in 1977. 12 collections later, his most recent one is called Sudden Loss of Dignity and came out earlier this year. The Gary Soto Literary Museum is located at Fresno City College, where he got his start as a poet. He is also a graduate of UC Irvine's own MFA program. Today, we're going to talk about his new book of essays, What Poets Are Like, Up and Down with the Writing Life, published by Sasquatch. It's his first time on the show, and we're delighted to have him. Gary, welcome.
Nicole, thank you for having me on your show. And yes, I'm an old anteater, a very old, one of the originals.
And we're so glad to have you. Could you tell us about your new essay collection?
Yes. What Poets Are Like is a collection of very small vignette-like essays that really talk about my own writing career, but also the careers and the histories of other writers, Faulkner, Virginia Woolf, Samuel Johnson, Pepys, and so on. And so it's sort of there's a conceit to this. It's that I'm kind of like second runner-up to lots of prizes, but not quite getting, that number one prize. And it's actually, I'm making fun of myself in this collection. And it's very readable as essays, even though it has a literary bend to it. It's not, I'm not going to embarrass academics, but it's not, dry.
I got the conceit, but when I got to the part about the library, I thought that was quite something.
Mm-hmm.
There are around 60 or so short essays. How did you go about figuring out what order to put them in?
Well, I think it's, if I could search my memory, such as it is these days, I think they were written in this particular order. Uh-huh. I may have juggled a few here and there and, moved things around, but they were written almost daily. And they're not unlike poems in that they're image-driven. Very little dialogue, just enough idea to sort of display my love of literature and learning, and they were just written like in each one almost daily.
They had that easy feel, and the maybe it was also their image drivenness, as you say. But they felt. I wondered what your revision process was like because they felt so natural and conversational yet crafted.
Mm-hmm. Well, Nicole, I'm a seasoned writer. I've been doing this thing for 37 years, and usually after 37 plus years, you get pretty good at what you're doing, and I have some bragging rights that way. But I'm a person, a poet who just will risk things and even some bad writing. And they just came out very naturally, and I'm pleased with the book, not sort of, in a conceited way, but just that it's out and available for other poets and other people who like, good yarns.
Mm-hmm. Will you read to us from your collection?
Okay, I will, and I'm going to start with a selection of, well, it's a lot of longish essay, but it's a little longer than the 2 minutes we're allowed here. But it's called Public Display of Affection. And I'm going to skip the first paragraph, but just imagine me, older guy, playing basketball with older guys as well. And I've benched myself, and now I'm getting off the bench. Mm-hmm. I pushed off the bench and made my way to the drinking fountain by the baseball diamond. On the muddy trail to the watering hole, I spied a ponytailed girl reading my chapter novel, Muddy Soul. She was seated comfortably on the grass, absorbed in a narrative in which the main character moves from Chicago's Pilsen neighborhood to the suburb of Des Plaines. Published in 2005, the novel came with a doll. Some would reverse this order and say that the doll came with a book. In a very short period of time, one splendid November, the book became my best seller. 250,000 dolls went home with girls. Whether the novel was read or not, I didn't care, because I, turncoat poet, received a sack of money that I first swung over my right shoulder and then my left shoulder. It was a really heavy sack. "Hi," I said to the girl, eager to admit that, yes, I wrote that book. "What do you think of it? Do you have any questions for me, author of this charming tale?" The girl gazed upward, using her finger as a bookmark. She was halfway through, and, if memory served, Marisol, the girl hero, was searching for her cat, Rascal. "You know," I continued, advancing the conversation, "I wrote that book." I smiled to give her evidence that in spite of my sweaty appearance, I was an all right guy. When she returned an indifferent scowl, as if beholding a piece of irrelevant gum embedded in a sidewalk, I reeled in my smile. Nothing stirred in her, nothing moved her to even utter, "Oh, really?" I hurried away to the water fountain and drank my fill in rapid gulps, afraid that the girl might skip off to her parents and report, "A dirty old man tried to talk to me." Then I headed home without raising my eyes into the rearview mirror. This relationship was like over. Later, I considered that incident was not unlike a compact mirror, a piece of glass, a shattered taillight in the street. It reflected on my narrow experience. I had finally gotten my wish to see a reader, albeit a child reader, with a book of mine in hand. I had been awestruck by other authors, big shots like John Grisham and Stephen King, and the hefty sales that kept them living nicely. What was their reaction when they came upon a reader turning a page of one of their books? Perhaps after that first elated encounter, the experience grows tiresome, a big yawner. Mr. Grisham expects readers, as does Mr. King. They expect their books to rise on the barometer of the bestseller list. Movies are made from the works of such authors. Even when there's no movie made, these heavy hitters yak it up, at least on the Charlie Rose show. This is not my story, though. I've done my song and dance for producers and directors, and have written Oprah. Isn't it time I begged Oprah for a poet, slender and Hispanic, very appealing, to be crowned on her show? The response from the global network, silence. And the little piece goes on, and the girl, of course, is scared of me. And that was my one time to see a reader of mine in a public space. And when I tried to befriend this child, it didn't work. So, you know, this is an example of what's available and what poets are like.
Of course, this is the dream of any writer, to have this experience encountering a reader in that, you know, reading their work. And it, mm-hmm. So that was the only time that's happened to you?
Well, no, actually, I've encountered, the book is kind of like, not sour grapes, but it's kind of making fun of me and what we expect what success is. And, you know, of course, for Mr. King or Grisham or the late Elmore Leonard, you know, maybe the success never is big enough. And, you know, I have a comfortable life. I'm writing my poetry, writing my essays. And, you know, I feel good. But, you know, there's always that, you know, that you know, that special thing that you're waiting for. And when it does come in the shape of a little girl, you know, it doesn't quite work out, for me at least.
There are a lot of fun, you know, lighter stories like that. And then there are some more serious ones. You had the experience of having one of your children's picture books banned in a school library in Clovis.
Yes, this was about 10 years ago, and it's my children's book called Chato's Kitchen. And I think, you know, parents and educators should be, you know, leery of things out there in the world. I mean, it is a frightening place. But, you know, for a picture book to be banned, you know, the language is appropriate, the storyline is appropriate. But for whatever image that's provided in the illustrator's rendering of the situation, well, it was frightening. And it was frightening this way, is that one parent, it's always one parent, complained that Chato was sort of invoking sort of gang attire, and the kids are suddenly going to read this book and tell, you know, turn into gangbangers. So far from the truth, if you know Clovis, California, and so far from the truth of what you know about me as a writer. But, you know, that's the risk we play, you know, we take. And we're often, you know, looked at because we render the world in such a way that it's sometimes we risk ourselves. And Chato, is, for me, was no risk at all. But I think the interpretation of literature sometimes will get skewed by a parent or two.
And what was striking about this was it was right next to your hometown, and it felt almost personal. Was it banned anywhere else in the country?
Well, let's just go back to Fresno. Fresno and Clovis are now mingled together, and I don't want to describe Clovis this way, but it has a little more conservative bend to it. And but what I really admired about the Fresnans, the good citizens of Fresno, is that they came to my defense. It was front page news, editorials, you know, the people got very loud, and in fact, in my essay, I call myself Zen Soda, where I didn't say anything. And, you know, of course, a lot of writers will jump on this and go, oh, gosh, you know, they're exploiting me, they're hurting me, blah, 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 but I was very quiet. And I just, you know, first, I don't know how I would defend the book, other than what I'm saying now, but in other parts of the country, I think one or two of my books have been banned, but again, that's always a good sign.
And you also have an essay about Harold Bloom.
Oh, yes, Mr. Harold Bloom. Oh, where do we begin there?
That was something. Would you like to talk about how your narrative became intertwined with, you know, his criticism or...
Well, I think that Professor Bloom is, you know, obviously a brilliant man. But someone asked him in Newsweek, oh, well, what about Gary Soto? And meeting me, the poet and author, barely getting by. And he says, oh, Gary Soto couldn't write himself out of a paper bag. That was in, I think it's Newsweek, if I'm correct. But they were talking about multicultural literature and how it's hijacking university curricula. And, you know, I'm just a poet and an essayist, and I'm not responsible if, in fact, there is a dumbing down in our world. And, you know, his response, of course, I ran with it. I mean, that's a good opportunity to run with a scholar. I didn't know I was on his radar. I mean, I didn't know he even thought about me, but... It maybe was just a knee-jerk response, but it was in Newsweek, and it was very prominent in the discussion of education and the faltering of the curricula, and I guess I was the poster child for that week.
Mm-hmm. That's, yeah. And so I'm going to ask you a question about your frequently asked questions on your website.
Mm-hmm.
So one of them is, who are your favorite writers? And I noticed that they're all men. Do you have any comments about that?
Oh, they're all men. I didn't know that. Okay. You know, I gave a tour of my museum yesterday, and probably on that list there, Nicole, would be Pablo Neruda. And I just saw him as, the person he sort of evoked to really change my life, and then, maybe become a poet. Then there's Knut Hamsun, the great Norwegian, Danish, whatever country he really resided in, and then we Garcia Marquez. And I don't know. I just if I'm going to be really truthful, I guess these some of the writers, I guess they're all men. They'll touch me in a way that really saved me from what my options were, which were not great. And it's not that I don't read women writers. There's so many wonderful Margaret Drabble, Elizabeth Bowen, Sylvia Plath, Parks, the playwright of Top Dog, Underdog, Sandra Cisneros. They're all writers who either taught me something or just gave me such an illuminating feeling when I read their work. So it's just not, it may be on that, there's just only males, but really not so.
Okay. And you get the impression from some of your essays that you're not a lover of technology.
Oh, boy. Where do I begin there?
So what is your relationship like with Facebook and Twitter?
I have no relationship. I have to brag that I'm the last person without a cell phone. Oh. And I've never had a cell phone. I have no desire to have a cell phone. I learned to cut and paste about 3 weeks ago. Didn't know how to do that. And the only person worse than me is another poet by the name of Lawson Inada, who has never had a computer. And Lawson said, "Hey, well, just you want to write me, Gary, write me an old-fashioned letter." I go, "My gosh, Lawson, you're worse than me, man." So I really enjoy books and holding them, being with them, magazines. And I think there's obviously a beauty of having this technology in hand to have the world at your fingertips, but I'm just going to refrain from it.
And that is understandable. And I also, on your website, you encourage your fans to write you an actual letter rather than, giving them an email address to just shoot something off. I thought that was...
Yeah. Every week I get about 50 fan letters. Saying, some of them saying I'm the greatest writer in the world. Of course, I am not. But in their estimation, fourth graders, fifth graders, I must be pretty good. I mean, I have a book out, and they're always touching, and they're all parts of the country. They're not simply California or the Fresno area. They come all the way from Rhode Island, Georgia, North Dakota. It's just the response to the work, my work. It's been very favorable, and I'm in a position. I answer all the letters. I told my wife that I spend about 10% of my income on stamps. It's just quite a bit of putting stamps on envelopes.
Well, that's something. We're drawing down on our time, Gary. But before we let you go, is there any writing advice that you can share with our listeners?
Writing advice, yes, I think that and most writers are people, young people or people who are establishing themselves as writers. It's just reading is so important. And I start off my day reading something in order to get that those juices going. And right now I'm very interested in this guy, E.V. Lucas, essayist from the 1920s, obscure, not read really, and all his books are out of print. But I look at his writing, I'm looking at his sentence patterns, his word choices, his subject matters, his intensity of emotion. Sometimes it's very cool English intensity. And I think that reading is so important. And of course, the second part is, you have to have friends who actually share the same passion that you're involved with. And it's either poetry or fiction or playwriting, you have to surround yourself with other people who are doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And your book can help to that end. Thank you so much for joining us today, Gary.
Nicole, it's my pleasure, and go anteaters in every in every capacity. Okay. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
That was Gary Soto, author of What Poets Are Like, published by Sasquatch, out and available in bookstores now. That's all the time we have for today. Barbara DeMarco Barrett will be here next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. And if you have time this weekend, she'll also be at the West Hollywood Book Fair, moderating a panel.